The third case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota intervener and appellant versus the Appalachian Feist and Lemieux Feist, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And Fosick, I understand that for the state, Ms. Jasper, who represents them as an assistant attorney general, will be speaking for 15 minutes. Is that correct?
Correct.
And Ms. Watson, you represent Feist and Lemieux Feist, and you'll be speaking for 10.
Correct.
Okay. And then for Fosick, we have Mr. Ginsbaugh and Ms. Stotler, and I understand, Ms. Stotler, you'll be presenting for 15 minutes.
Yes.
Correct. And then 10-minute rebuttal for the state. Okay. All right. We'll proceed then, and Ms. Jasper, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. The matter before you right now involves a constitutional challenge to South Dakota Statute 25-529 through 25-534, which I'm going to refer to as Timmy's Law. Mother asserted, and the trial court found, that Timmy's Law violated the 14th Amendment due process rights and found it unconstitutional on their face.
No, isn't the trial court required to follow Meldrum, which is the basis of Timmy's Law?
Correct. The Meldrum versus Novotny, the second one, is the basis for the statutes that were passed. Correct.
Okay.
There was no evidence or testimony taken in this matter, and no findings of facts were entered by the trial court. The state asserts that the trial court erred in finding the Timmy's Law facially unconstitutional, and bases that on three main points. The first point is that there's a strong presumption that statutes are constitutional that has not been rebutted, that the challenge in this particular case to the constitutionality occurred procedurally too early, and that Timmy's Law is not vague and does provide Mother with her due process rights. Briefly for the court, I'll give a...
Did he find it on vagueness, or did he say it was vague?
The order that the court entered stated that it was overbroad and vague.
Overbroad and vague, okay.
Correct. The brief procedural outline is that a petition was filed by the grandparents in this case, who father was living with, for third-party custody of the child. Mother at the time was living with her father as well. Several months later, a notice regarding the question of constitutionality was filed, and then the state was intervened in the matter, and the court dismissed it without taking any evidence. With regard to my first point, that there's a strong presumption that statutes are considered constitutional, they have to be rebutted by the challenger beyond a reasonable doubt and prove that the violation was clear, palpable, and plain. And that did not happen in this case. Because if within the bounds of reasonable construction, a statute can be read constitutional, that's the construction that should be adopted by the court. Second point is that in this particular case, the constitutional question came too early. It came before any facts or evidence were taken in the matter. Challenges that involve the First Amendment must be examined in light of, challenges that do not involve the First Amendment must be examined in light of the specific facts of the case, and not with regard to the statute's spatial validity. Due process challenges, which involve the void for vagueness doctrine, also are limited to review to the specific facts of the case, according to the State v. Amundson. As I stated earlier, there are no facts in this case. There is no factual background in which to analyze whether or not Timmy's Law was constitutional with regard to this particular parent.
Wasn't his decision, the trial court's decision, is that it didn't contain, the statute itself does not require any finding of unfitness. Isn't that the reason he's looking at it on its face and saying this isn't constitutional, because it would need to find unfitness before you can give custody to a third party?
That was what was argued as well as what the court found. However, it did not say, the statute itself does not say the word unfitness, which does lead me into my next point, which is that the statute isn't vague, that it does allow reasonable people of ordinary intelligence to understand what's going on.
Well, what about overbroad, though? Would it be overbroad if it doesn't have that in there?
Mother challenged this statute based on due process. The overbreadth analysis is generally used when looking at First Amendment freedom of speech issues and not with regard to the 14th Amendment due process, which is the vagueness argument.
All right. So the trial court, you're just saying they used the wrong, that he used the wrong standard.
Essentially, yes, and used it too soon. The standard, as I said, was whether a reasonable person of ordinary intelligence would understand. When you're looking at the language of 25529, which is the first statute at issue, it clearly contains language that says, it is presumed to be in the best interests of the child to be in the care, custody, and control of the child's parent, and the parent shall be afforded the constitutional protections as determined by the United States Supreme Court and the South Dakota Supreme Court. That language was pointed out in this court's recent decision in SMN as not overriding the holding that a natural parent is guaranteed certain constitutional rights, but it supports that finding. Further, that statement is followed by a parent's presumptive right to custody. When taken into context of what the standard is, that there must be some showing of unfitness by a parent or some showing of harm before a child can be removed from that care, that standard is provided by that language, as well as the remaining language in the statutes. 25529 provides four reasons in which a presumptive right can be overturned. The first one being abandonment or persistently neglected. The next one being forfeited, surrendered. The third, abdicated. The parents abdicated their parental rights or responsibilities. And the fourth one is extraordinary circumstances. And that's where most of the argument in this case was involving is what is extraordinary circumstances and what do those mean?
The first three are basically fitness. If you abandon your child, you're not a fit parent, right? So it really is, why was the court given the option or was it proposed to the court that it could strike part of the statute and rather than just striking a whole series of statutes?
I don't know if that was presented to the court or not. I don't recall it being in the briefs that were filed, but that is an option as well. I know that that was done, I believe it was in the visitation statute, there was something about there's a presumption that a child's best interest is to visit their grandparent, and I don't remember what case it was, but there was a decision that handed down that the overall statute is constitutional when you strike that portion. So that is something that can be done. The other important thing that you note, Justice Cunningham, is that those first three are clearly fitness findings with regard to abandonment, forfeiture, and so forth. When you look at the extraordinary circumstances language, there's 10 subsections. When you cross-reference, for lack of a better word, 25529 and 25530 with the abuse and neglect statute, 26882, you'll find similar language in both of those. 26882 has been found numerous times as complying that there is sufficient warning provided within those statutes that a reasonable person of ordinary intelligence would understand. There's volumes of case law involving what is or is not abuse and neglect that would apply because of that previous statement in 529, that would apply to these statutes as well. The interesting thing about when you look at the fact that the ANN statutes have been upheld constitutionally versus this statute is that the ANN statutes are looked at pursuant to 26785 in light of the child's best interests, where the backdrop in 25529 Timmy's Law is not the child's best interest. It's the strong presumption given to the parents that they have a right to custody of their child.
You think the presumption is enough to save it? Is that what you're saying? I guess I'm not following you.
The first thing I'm saying is that it happened too soon. It should be analyzed within the facts of the case so that you have the factual backdrop. But yes.
But then if so, what is the law that they're going to apply? And is the presumption enough to make it constitutional, or does there have to be something more than that?
I think the statute as written, there's enough when read in whole. If you take certain parts individually, they may not be. But when you read it in whole and the fact that 25530 relies on serious detriment, harm, there has to be some sort of harm to the child. And what is an unfit parent? When you look at the Meldrum decision, Meldrum versus Novotny, there's an area of discussion that unfitness isn't just outright physical abuse and those things. There's more to unfitness than the obvious hitting abandonment type of issues. And that's what is laid out in 25.
So is that, are you saying, I guess, just so that I'm understanding what you're arguing, that you're saying actually that the statute does have to be, have the component of unfitness in it. In order to give custody to a non-parent, there has to be unfitness found one way or another. Are you, is that what you're saying?
I'm not arguing that it does not provide that.
Okay.
I'm arguing that it does.
This statute says, or the extraordinary circumstances. Can that be constitutional as well?
And
do we have to address that? Do we have to squarely determine here that it's unfitness and extraordinary circumstance doesn't cut it?
When you look at what extraordinary circumstances are and you look at 25530, the first thing it says is serious detriment to a child may exist. The reading of 25530 is that these are different definitions of what unfitness may be. These are circumstances that may, in certain circumstances, under certain facts, if they result in serious detriment to a child, may result in a parent being unfit to have custody of that child for that period of time. Does that answer your question, Justice Meyer-Henry?
I think so. So what you're saying is that extraordinary circumstances in the way it's defined in 25530 really means unfitness.
It's providing further definition for unfitness. It's giving that term more meaning than what it has alone.
What about subsection 5?
The substantial enhancement of the child's well-being under the care of a person other than the parent. Without a factual backdrop, in this case, I can see cases where it could potentially become one of those cases where it's enough. I don't know. Alone, it still has to have serious detriment involved. There has to be some showing that what the child isn't getting under the care of their parent is providing serious detriment where they could get something more from somebody else. The language that was used in 25530 is what was used in Justice Konenkamp's concurrence for the most part in the Meldrum case. And that language was based on statutes in other states that had found similar language constitutional under the serious detriment, extraordinary circumstances test. The other thing I'd like to point out back to the similarities between the ANN statutes as well as the third party custody statutes is actually some of the differences in the fact that the ANN statutes are held as constitutional. When you look at the ANN statutes, a parent is looking at termination of parental rights. They're not with this third party custody statute. Termination is not one of the things that occurs. Under the ANN statutes, they also have the ability to remove the child for emergency purposes for a lower burden of proof. This court has stated that the third party custody statutes have to have clear and convincing evidence. With an emergency removal of the child, the burden of proof is reasonable suspicion for the first removal and then probable cause at the 48-hour hearing that follows. The ANN statutes seem to have more detriment to a parent than this particular statute, yet they've already been held constitutional by this court previously.
But there's a whole other set of things that are in that chapter of what the state can't just go in and do it. They've got to make certain steps and do certain things. And I mean, I don't know if the scheme is the same.
The scheme is not the same. It's a longer process in the ANN statutes, or could be a longer process in the ANN statutes, in part to build the family. But the point is that, and I probably didn't make it as clear as I intended to, the state's compelling interest in becoming, taking over the parent paid, the parental role in a family in the ANN statute, they're allowing the state to actually take custody of the child. In this particular case, what the state did was they enacted this law in that same capacity, allowing a third party to come in cases where it's deemed necessary, based on the facts of the case, to take custody of the child in a less restrictive setting than in the ANN setting, where the parent isn't faced with termination of parental rights, where the parent can come back in and get custody at some point in the future when things allow for that. I see that my time is about to expire. I would just rely on the brief that I filed and ask that the court order dismissal, or that the order of dismissal be reversed in this case and remanded, and that the Timmy laws be found constitutional. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jasper. Ms. Watson, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Deborah Watson, and I am the attorney for the paternal grandparents who initiated this third-party custody action. Their granddaughter, who just turned 4, was born out of wedlock to their son and his former girlfriend. The facts which precipitated the filing of this action were these. The parents were basically homeless, living with family members. Neither parent was able to maintain steady employment.
Except none of those facts are really what are before us in this case. The only thing before us is the constitutionality of the statute, because there were no findings made by the child court.
There were no
findings.
You never
got that far, did you?
Right. We did not. There was no evidentiary hearing. We filed a petition.
So you may win under your facts if this is constitutional and it's applied constitutionally. But first we have to decide whether or not we can use the statute.
Exactly. But I just kind of wanted to give you a little history about how we got here today. So both parents had been using illegal drugs. Domestic violence was prevalent in their relationship. Both parents suffered mental health issues. Dad was bipolar. Both parents had suffered depression. Both parents had been institutionalized for mental health issues. And the child had been left for extended periods of time with the paternal grandparents, who had become her de facto parents.
Did the Department of Social Services get involved in this? This sounds like an abuse and neglect case.
There were referrals to the department. They were not substantiated. And, of course, in a lot of these cases, that happens, because we have grandparents, aunts, uncles, daycare providers who step in and make sure the child's safe. So when the department steps in, that's where the child's at. So these are a little different than our typical abuse and neglect cases. As Justice Meyer Henry indicated, we didn't get to the evidentiary hearing, but there was a child custody evaluation ordered by the court and offered. It's contained in the file. Mother picked the evaluator. It was Dr. Leslie Pfeifferman, a local psychologist in Rapid City. He, in fact, determined that neither party parent was fit and recommended to the court that the paternal grandparents be given third-party custody. And then the court addressed the constitutional issue before we could get to an evidentiary hearing. The constitutional challenge occurred.
Do you, you're talking about unfit parent here. Do you believe the statute needs to specifically say that?
I don't believe so, and quite frankly, I was going to agree with Ms. Jasper's argument, but I think maybe I differ with her a little bit there. The fitness standard really goes to the parents, and I believe I've sort of been in the trenches in family law. We do see fit parents who do abdicate their parental responsibility for a number of reasons. Some of them are good. Sometimes they have such a toxic relationship with the ex-spouse that these children have no chance to have a normal lifestyle if either the mom or the dad continues in the relationship. Sometimes we have Solomon, who just steps away from the situation just because it's so toxic. So I do think that there are fit parents who may abandon their...
So then that would fall under the extraordinary.
It would.
Extraordinary. And is that, can you take the extraordinary, the or, unfit or extraordinary, and say that that's enough of a standard to meet Troxel or constitutional rights of due process for a parent? Is that enough? Are extraordinary circumstances or that part of the statute, is that enough and is it constitutional? Even if you find a fit parent on the other hand.
Well, in Troxel, you know, it dealt with the best interests in terms of a visitation, but here we have a two-prong test, and I don't think extraordinary circumstances are sufficient. The first prong of the test is that the third-party custodian must have served as a primary caretaker, been closely bonded as a parental figure, or otherwise formed a significant and substantial relationship. That's number one. Then number two, in order to overcome the presumption, the constitutional presumption, and it's pretty rare that we put in statutes that there is a constitutional presumption, but we wanted to remind the trial court that there's probably no more important right than a parent to raise their child. So we wanted to remind the trial court of that. But the presumptive right to custody may be rebutted by proof that the parents abandoned or persistently neglected the child, forfeited or surrendered their parental rights, abdicated, or there's extraordinary circumstances. But the key word, I think here, or key words, is serious detriment to the child. When we talk about unfitness, we're talking about the parent. When we're talking about harm or serious detriment, we're talking about the child. And that's where we wanted to keep the focus, is on the child.
So you would suggest you don't necessarily need parental unfitness if you have serious detriment.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Right. I think that there are cases where unfitness may not be present, but that there may be serious detriment to the child to go with that parent. And the court ruled that the statute was unconstitutional as vague and overbroad, and I think that the statute, I'd submit that it's very specific, and it does give clear information to parents as to what is expected in terms of their role. My role today is really to share the perspective of a family law lawyer who's in the trenches doing these family law cases. The composition of families has changed. It's not like we knew it. We have almost 40% of our children born out of wedlock. 1 in 12 children are living with grandparents. This has become an all-too-common phenomenon, and we need a legal mechanism to address the needs of children whose parents aren't able to or don't care for them. And the third-party custody statute provided that mechanism. Before the third-party custody statute was enacted in 2002, we had these children living with third-party custodians, but they weren't able to get them medical care. They weren't able to enroll them in school. They weren't able to get them on their health insurance. They weren't able to get access to government benefits. And actually, these children were kind of ping-pong back and forth. The parents, you know, if they wanted something from the third-party custodian, you know, they just held up this little child as sort of the bait to get what they wanted from usually their parents, the grandparents. So it was not a very enviable position for these little children to be in.
No, I think no one disputes that. However, I think that it's probably with Troxel. I mean, it talks about a fundamental right of a parent, and you can't overlook that.
No, you certainly can, and that's why it's in the statute specifically that parents have a constitutional right. But the government should not take that right lightly. Rarely should they interfere with the parent's right to raise their child. But on the other hand, we have parents patriae where the court has to protect children from harm, including harm caused by the ones they may love the most, their parents. So these are really difficult cases, and there's lots of factual scenarios that result in serious detriment to the child. And And the court needs to step in where there is serious detriment to the child to protect the child. I think that the harm standard better balances the child's relationship with his parent alongside his relationship with a long-standing third-party primary caregiver better than the unfitness standard. We have lots of scenarios. We have the Novotny-Meldrum scenario where the dad allowed the mom to take the child, and they kind of both went on with their own lives, although the father had some involvement and offered to pay child support. We have the situation here where it's our position that the parents were unfit. We have situations where parents alienate the children and the absent parent is seen as the devil incarnate. You know, placing children in those circumstances is pretty hazardous to their well-being. We also have parents who are overwhelmed and they just can't care for the children that they brought into the world. And so this third-party custody statute really provides this safety net for these young children. And I'm asking that you find the statute constitutional and allow us to proceed with an evidentiary hearing. And thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. Ms. Stoutler, you have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Courtney Stoutler, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Ashley Fosick, who's also the mother in this case. Today I will be addressing the issue before the court today, whether South Dakota codified laws 25529 through 34 are constitutional. It's the appellee's position that Judge Tice was correct in ruling that those statutes, also known as South Dakota's third-party custody statutes, are unconstitutional for three reasons. First, these statutes deprive a fit parent in South Dakota of their due process rights to the care, custody, and control of their children. Secondly, the language that's being used in these third-party custody statutes is overly broad and vague, and it creates the potential for an otherwise fit parent to lose their custodial rights to someone who has simply formed a relationship with their child. And finally, Your Honors, these statutes fail under a strict scrutiny analysis because there exists no compelling justification for a third party to impose custodial rights over a parent without a determination of unfitness or harm to that child, and there does exist a least restrictive alternative for the appellant and the grandparents in this case to pursue. Now, South Dakota's third-party custody statutes are currently depriving South Dakota parents of their due process rights in making decisions regarding the care, custody, and control of their children, because these statutes allow for a third party to come in without any determination of parental unfitness before interfering with their rights. The 14th Amendment of the Constitution, as well as South Dakota's Bill of Rights, specifically state that no state shall deprive any person of their life, liberty, or property interest. Now, the United States Supreme Court has recognized in Troxell that parents have a fundamental liberty interest in the care, custody, and control of their children. And based upon this interest, parents have a right to establish a home, to direct the upbringing of their children, and to control their child's education. And the state may not sever such rights unless it's proven by clear and convincing evidence that these parents are unfit to take care of their children.
All right. Must have been a profound statement. Yeah. Everybody jumped in. Go ahead.
No, nobody's going to ask.
No?
Okay.
Well,
can't this be applied, though, in a constitutional manner and address all those things that you're concerned about?
As the statutes are currently set forth, Your Honor, no.
Why?
We can't.
Why not?
Well, first, Your Honor,
we don't even know how they were going to be applied, because he didn't apply it, he didn't take any evidence, didn't make any findings.
That's right, Your Honor. They're unconstitutional on their face, first of all, because they allow any person other than a parent to petition at any time for custody, which directly goes against what the United States Supreme Court held in Troxell, that allowing any person to petition at any time for visitation rights is entirely too broad. If it's entirely too broad for a visitation statute, then it must be entirely too broad.
Troxell found that the in the best interests was not the proper determination. It was a plurality decision, sent it back to Washington and said it's got to be more than just best interests of the child.
Correct.
Isn't that what it said?
Yes.
It didn't say it was overbroad or anything else. In fact, there's language in here that says that it depends on how it's applied. So, I mean, even in Troxell, they didn't find it on its face unconstitutional, even the plurality, did they?
No, Your Honor, not on their face. However, the court in Troxell pointed out that that language, allowing any person to petition at any time, is being swept too broadly. And in our statutes, we allow for any person at any time to petition for custody.
But just a minute. You can't read any person at any time in isolation. Don't you have to read any person at any time in light of all the other requirements that are in Section 29?
Yes, any person at any time who has served as a caretaker, bonded as a parental figure, or formed some sort of significant or substantial relationship has to overcome the parental presumption by 1 through 4.
And then there's 4 subdivisions and abandonment, surrendered rights. These are all things that Troxell would encompass. Troxell would permit intervention if a parent is abandoned or neglected the child.
Your Honors, Judge Tice found that these 1 through 4 subsections are not being properly defined. They're not giving proper guidance to a trial court, such as himself, to make a determination as to what constitutes abandonment, what constitutes forfeiture or surrender of rights, what constitutes abdication of parental responsibilities that would allow some third party who's formed a bond with the child to come in and petition for custodial rights.
We've often said, though, that the courts can interpret a statute to be constitutional. In other words, by the interpretation that we give to the statute may be more restrictive than perhaps what the legislature had in mind, but by interpreting it in a restrictive way can be constitutional. And doesn't the legislature in this case invite us to do that in Section 29, where it says that the parents are entitled to all the protections afforded by the United States Supreme Court and the South Dakota Supreme Court? They're in effect inviting us to make sure that whatever protections are left out in the statute, that we would impose those.
That's correct, Your Honor. The statute does have that language in there. However, that statute doesn't elaborate as to what exactly constitutional protections this court should afford, what constitutional protections the Supreme Court has afforded. The statute should specifically state what should be afforded. It shouldn't be allowed for interpretation on a piecemeal basis.
Aren't they saying all of them? All protections?
Maybe, or a few, or none. It's not clear by this statute, Your Honor. This court in Meldrum stated that in legal contests between a parent and a non-parent for custody of a child, the threshold question must be, is that parent unfit to have custody of that child? And this court went on further to state that if that question is not answered in the affirmative, without some showing of unfitness, then the best interests of the child are not even at issue. Here, these third-party custody statutes allow a third party to bypass that threshold question. They allow a third party only to establish a bond between them and that child and some sort of more extravagant means for caring for that child.
Aren't there things that are equivalent to unfitness, though? I mean, you say unfitness is the key. Are there other things, other elements that are equivalent to it?
Perhaps there are, Your Honor. We're not sure what those equivalent standards would be. 1, 2, and 3 refer to abandonment, forfeiture, and abdication, but it doesn't define what those are.
But aren't those things equivalent to unfitness? Don't they the same effect? You have an unfit parent equals a child who's not being cared for properly. All those other things equal the same thing. So aren't they, in a sense, equivalent to unfitness?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but then you also must look at subsection number 4, which says any other extraordinary circumstance, and then it refers you to 25.530, which lists 1 through 10 of those extraordinary circumstances.
Why couldn't the judge have just, I mean, we've often said that, when the court finds a statute unconstitutional, if the rest of the statute can be salvaged, then only the portion that's unconstitutional should be stricken. But here the court strikes everything. He strikes, multiple sections, the entire statute. Why couldn't the statute be salvaged? If you're right, if your argument is correct about the extraordinary circumstances, why couldn't that be excised and still we would have a constitutional statute?
Because, Your Honor, we are still not specifically finding an unfitness determination before a third party can step in and assert custodial rights over
a
child.
On the unfitness, in Troxell there were 4 writings or 5, and I don't think any of them specifically said the only that you have to absolutely have unfitness as the only basis. So was that in any of the writings, that was the only determination?
No, Your Honor, but it should be a determination in this state before a third party can step in and assert custodial rights over
a
parent.
We're clear. You're not saying that that's a requirement in Troxell. You're saying that we should define it even more restrictive than Troxell.
Your Honor, the court in Troxell was concerned about any person being allowed to come in at any time to petition for visitation rights.
Petition or being found to be entitled to it are 2 different things. I mean, let's talk about outcome, not petitioning.
The court found that the language that was being used in that statute was allowing a third party to step in and assert or subject any decision that's being made by a parent concerning custody to state court review. And every time that petition is filed, every time that comes before a trial court, that parent, who has yet to be proven unfit, that parent's decisions in the care, custody, and control of their child is given no deference. And then once a court decides that some third party, according to these statutes, has a bond with that child and can perhaps afford a better financial or educational means for that child, then that court can make a decision and take custody rights away from that parent and give it to that third party. And that deprives that fit parent of their fundamental right to the care, custody, and control of their child. Now, we have other statutes in South Dakota concerning the custodial rights of a parent, and those statutes require some sort of showing of parental unfitness or harm to the child. For instance, the abuse and neglect statutes. Before a state can exercise its police power in interfering with the rights to raise a child, some determination must be made that the child's health, welfare, or safety are in danger. Additionally, our guardianship proceedings. This court held in THM that an abuse and neglect determination must occur before a guardian is appointed, before that custody determination is made. And this court went on further in that opinion.
But didn't THM, it partially got overruled, didn't it, by Timmy's Law? I mean, that was, because THM was a question of whether the guardianship laws and the abuse and neglect laws could coexist.
Right.
And Timmy's Law was sort of an answer to that, wasn't it?
Well, shortly after the THM case, the legislature actually amended the Guardianship Act to allow any person to petition. But in the THM case, this court explained the significant constitutional safeguards that have to be afforded to a parent before you can interfere with the custody and abuse and neglect proceeding.
What about the language, a parent's presumptive right to custody of his or her child must be rebutted by proof? And then why isn't a parent's presumptive right enough to in this statute? Why isn't that language enough to protect the due process rights of a parent? Because it's a presumption. They come in, it's presumed that
yes,
they get custody.
Yes, Your Honor. It's a presumption. However, it's very easily overruled using 1 through 9 in 25.530. If someone comes in, for instance, and says they have a significant and substantial relationship with your child And then they used the extraordinary circumstance number 5, for example, that a substantial enhancement of that child's well-being occurs while that person takes care of that child. That can be broadly interpreted as someone who's bonded with your child, who has more money than you, and who can perhaps expose this child to more opportunities.
Yeah, you should have custody. Subsection 5 might be suspect, but create an example out of one of the other ones.
Subsection, sorry.
Go ahead.
Subsection 9, Your Honor. Someone who's established a bond with a child and can prove to the extent which the child's right to an education would be impaired. That can be broadly interpreted as the parent lives in a rural, less advantageous school district. That third party lives in a more well-supported by tax dollars school district. And therefore, that child's education is being impaired and that third party gets custody. The overly broad language of these extraordinary circumstances is what the court in Troxell warned against. The latitude to decide what's in the best interest of the child is being left solely in a trial court's discretion.
What about subsection 1? There's nothing unclear about serious physical or emotional harm. That certainly has to be constitutional.
You're correct, Your Honor. The likelihood of serious physical or emotional harm would meet the harm requirement, but it's the only one out of these 10 subsections that even mentions harm.
Well, then why shouldn't that survive?
Your Honor, it shouldn't survive because the statute as a whole is depriving a parent, has the potential to deprive a parent of their fundamental right to the care, custody, and control of their child without specifically proving unfitness on that parent's behalf.
Your time has expired. Thank you, Ms. Stoller.
May I have a moment to conclude, Your Honor?
No.
Thank you.
You have 10 minutes, Ms. Jasper.
Thank you, Your Honor. To start, I just want to respond to the mother's argument that she was deprived her due process. The reason she was deprived her due process in this particular case is because she moved to facially challenge the constitutionality of the statute. The court didn't have a chance to provide her the due process that was given under the statutes. She thwarted it. We don't know what the trial court would have ruled. We don't know under the facts of the case, we don't know the facts, whether or not custody would have been removed from this mother. To me, that's an interesting fact. It's interesting that they argue due process, but they were the ones themselves that stopped the due process from going forward. The other thing that I want to point out is that she mentioned Judge Tice did not have enough guidance in this case. However, in the December 11th, 2008 motion hearing, he himself recognized what's required by the statute by saying on page 6, we're talking about a serious finding that this court has to make prior to any consideration of change of custody from a biological parent, and that's a huge hurdle to overcome. Judge Tice knew what the hurdle was in this particular case. It's clear by reading the statutes what is that there's a presumptive right to the parent and what is required in order to overcome that to provide custody to a third party. There's a lot of talk about what could happen and what may happen, but that's why these cases are looked at on the facts. And that's why this statute should not have been challenged based on a facial constitutionality, but should have been analyzed under the facts of this case. And as I stated earlier, for that reason alone, the fact that this challenge was brought too early, the matter should be reversed and the order dismissed.
Let me follow up on that a little bit. You know, one principle of judicial opinion making is we decide cases as narrowly as possible. Is the remedy in this case for us to declare the statute constitutional if we adopt your view, or should this be sent back to the trial court to develop a factual record and then let the trial court determine if it's constitutional under the facts of the case?
From the case law, and my interpretation of it, the best approach is to remand it back for a determination, for a factual finding, and for the statute to be analyzed under the facts of the case. Based on what Asmussen says, and all of Troxell, all of the cases that have analyzed these third-party constitutional statutes, they all analyze them under the facts of the case. Even the ones that analyze third-party visitation cases have been analyzed under the specific facts of the case. I think it's important that it does get analyzed under the specific facts of the case and that
would be the easiest decision by this court to make would be to reverse it based on that alone. That answer your question, Justice Center? I'm not.
Are you asking us to declare it unconstitutional? Are you asking us to send it back and let the trial court make that decision?
I think it's
in the first instance under the facts of the case.
I think it should be sent back to the trial court to make a determination as applied, whether or not it's constitutional as applied, not facially, because of the challenge that was made in this particular case, due process. It's an as-applied challenge rather than a facial challenge that was made. Ms. Stotler pointed out that subsection 9, the extent to which a child's right to education would be impaired while in the custody of the parent, could be suspect. However, when you compare that with 26882, subsection 4, whose parent, guardian, or custodian fails or refuses to provide proper or necessary education, it's similar to what is provided within the ANN statute. Could there be broad interpretations? There could always be broad interpretations about any word. But the point is that you've got to show serious detriment, which shows that there has to be some sort of harm. If a child is harmed seriously, there has to be some sort of unfitness by a parent. The statute was written broadly just in case certain scenarios under the facts of the case were created that would require the court, or not require the court, but where the child is at such a serious state of harm that custody is better placed with a third party rather than with the parent, because the parent clearly isn't doing their job if the child is in that serious of a position. The state would just again assert, unless there's further questions, that this matter be remanded and reversed back to the trial court for determination of constitutionality based on the facts or found constitutional on its face. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jasper. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.